Good evening. This is Ruth Kovach. We're bringing you Prison Pipeline. Welcome to our program. I'm always glad to have all of you listening to us. Tonight we're going to have a telephone interview with Bo Lazoff, who is the author of a wonderful, fine book that I talked about a couple weeks ago, and I'll let him introduce that book when we get him on the air. But before we talk to him, let's hear our words from Mamiya.
Before Guantanamo, or Abu Ghraib, was the Black Panthers. Long before the words Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib entered common American usage as reference points for government torture, there were several young black men who knew something about the subject. The year, 1973, and among 13 black militants arrested in a New Orleans sweep were three men, Hank Jones, John Bowman, and Ray Boudreau. The three were beaten, tortured, and interrogated by New Orleans cops, acting on tips supplied by San Francisco police. The men were stripped, beaten with blunt objects, blindfolded, shocked on their private parts by electric cattle prods, punched, kicked, and had wool blankets soaked in boiling water thrown over them. Under such torture, the three gave false confessions in a shooting of a San Francisco cop in 1971. The charges were eventually thrown out after a judge in California found that the prosecution had failed to tell a grand jury that the confessions were exacted under torture. Today, over 30 years later, Jones, Bowman, and Boudreau have again been called before a grand jury to try to resurrect what was dismissed in 1976. Imagine what these men thought when they heard about the U.S. government torture chambers in Guantanamo or Abu Ghraib in Iraq. The names may have been different, but the grim reality was the same. Today, these men have formed the Committee for the Defense of Human Rights to try to teach folks about what happened so many years ago and what is happening now. Their living example teaches us that history repeats itself, but in worse, more repressive forms. That's because their first conflicts with the state took place under the aegis of the since-discredited COINTELPRO counterintelligence program. That program, after the famous church committee hearings in the Senate, was declared illegal and a violation of the U.S. Constitution. Today, thanks to a Congress weakened by corporate largesse and frightened by 9/11, the same things that were illegal in the 70s have been all but resurrected and legalized under the notorious Patriot Act. What we are seeing all across the nation is the emergence of what the late Black Panther Minister of Information, Eldridge Cleaver, called Yankee Doodle Fascism, the rise of corporate and state power to attack dissidents and destroy even the pretension of civil rights. I say pretension because the events I discussed earlier happened in 1973, yet none of the torturers, the violators, the criminals in blue, ever were sanctioned for their violations of state, federal, and indeed international law. To this day, not one. Think of this. The murderers of Fred Hampton Sr., those malevolent minions of the state who crept into his home and shot him dead as he slept, have never served a day, a minute, a second in jail for this most premeditated of murders planned at the highest levels of the U.S. government. The roots of Guantanamo, of Abu Ghraib, of Bagram Air Force Base, of U.S. secret torture chambers operating all around the world are deep in American life and its long war against black life and liberation. Is it mere coincidence that the most notorious guard at Abu Ghraib worked right here in the U.S., here in Pennsylvania? No, here in SCI Green for over 6 years before exporting his brand of corrections to the poor slobs who met him in Iraq? Back in the 60s and 70s, Panthers and others spoke about fascism, but it had an edge of hyperbole, of radical speech, to move people beyond their complacency. Several years ago, a political scientist who studied fascism on three continents came to some pretty sobering conclusions. According to Dr. Lawrence Britt, fascist states have 14 characteristics in common. They are briefly, 1, powerful nationalism, 2, disdain for human rights, 3, scapegoating to unify against so-called enemies, 4, military supremacy, 5, rampant sexism, 6, controlled mass media, 7, national security obsessions, 8, government religiosity, 9, rise of corporate power, 10, suppression of labor, 11, anti-intellectualism, 12, obsession with punishment, 13, deep corruption and cronyism, and last, 14, fraudulent elections. How many of these features are reflected daily in the national life of the United States? What happens abroad is a grim reflection of what has happened here, albeit quietly. The tortures of Jones, Bowman, and Boudreau won't be featured stories on Nightline, nor on the supposedly liberal NPR. Remember the characteristics of a controlled mass media? What happens overseas has its genesis in the monstrous history of what happened here. Genocide, mass terrorism, and racist exploitation, also known as slavery, land theft and carnage. All of these horrors have been echoed abroad, shadows of hatred, xenophobia, and fear projected from the heart of the empire outwards. If we really want to change the dangerous trend of global repression, we must change it here first, for only then can the world breathe a deep sigh of relief. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal, author of We Want Freedom, A Life in the Black Panther Party, which features a chapter on COINTELPRO.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison.
Well, thank you, Mumia. I hope I didn't cut you off, but Mumia always has good things to say, and now I'm very pleased to tell you that I do have Bo Lazoff on the line. He is the author of a fine book, We're All Doing Time. He has spent many years working with prisoners with a program that I'm going to let him talk about. Are you on the line now, Bo?
Yes, I am.
It's so good to see you. This is Ruth. I guess I can't see you, but it feels like you're right here. I wanted to ask you a few questions, unless you wanted to say some greeting first before my first question, or just identify yourself any further than I have.
Well, Bo Lazoff here, just kind of waiting to go.
Very good. The first question I was going to ask was, could you talk to us a bit about your work in the prisons? I had the privilege of hearing you speak last week one day, and that question was asked, and you told so many interesting things which you took from your book, We're All Doing Time, and from your life experiences. Please share those things with us now.
Well, officially, I'm director of Human Kindness Foundation and the Prison Ashram Project, which is called the world's largest interfaith prison ministry. But that sounds a little simplistic because I think a lot of people go into prisons to with the idea we're going to help these poor convicts cope with prison life, and I don't go in with that idea at all. That's not, to me, what our ministry is about. I go into prisons for several reasons: to communicate with my brothers and sisters who are behind bars and help them, A, grow much bigger than some small insect that needs to cope with anything. Grow bigger than the prison, bigger than the cultural problems that we have all around us, and so in that way, it's very much about spiritual activism, spiritual practices. But also, I'm often the first person who comes into a prisoner's life to have a fairly deep philosophical conversation. Well, what's life about? What's life about? How much have we ever asked ourselves that question? We're trying to just pay bills and get more stuff and, you know, somehow make our way through this unbelievably superficial consumer lifestyle that we have crammed at us all day and night. So being in prison is an interesting thing. You're kind of shoved away from being as able to be addicted to consumerism and overstimulation as the mainstream population. It's like when a person sentenced to prison, the train of society comes to a stop on the tracks, opens the door, and throws their butt down the embankment, and shuts the door and goes on without them. And I come in some, you know, 10 years, 15, 16 years later and say, by the way, you know that train that threw you off? Well, it wrecked. The train wrecked after it threw you off. So it's not such a bad idea to have been thrown off that train. Because what I mean by the train wrecked is the United States has the unhappiest people on earth by statistics of antidepressant prescriptions written. The United States statistically has the most violent, the most homicidal, the most suicidal children who have ever been born in any age on any continent in the planet. So I'd call the most violent, angry children and the most unhappy adults in the world a train wreck. And if we look to see some of the mechanics of that wreck, we see two serious addictions that prisoners have been prevented from being as caught in. And one is having to buy constantly, just focus our whole lives around stuff. If we have a problem, we need to either buy a product or hire an expert.
Why, that's true.
It requires spending money. Prisoners have been put in a situation where, since we don't allow them to handle money, when they have a problem, they have to do the old-fashioned thing. They have to reach inward for inner strength. They have to reach out to the people right around them. And they have to figure out how to solve their own damn problem.
You seem to be the first voice that they hear that they can talk about these things with. I'm assuming the rehabilitation programs are so inadequate throughout the nation that talking to you is like a light in the dark, a door opening that they've never had a chance to look at. Is that true?
Well, I think it's just a more honest conversation because, as you just noted, most rehabilitation programs come in with very sweet people who are trying to do something for the poor prisoner as though the culture outside is this great thing to join.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is just with the prisoner. I come in as a radical activist saying, by the way, the culture out there is a mess, and we actually need some of the qualities that you've developed in response to the unfair and brutal conditions that we've subjected you to. Because, like I just said, they haven't been allowed to become as weak and dependent on buying products and hiring experts as the people outside in the streets. And so they've got some inner strength. They've developed some self-reliance that people on the streets are really giving up. And the second thing they haven't been allowed to be as addicted to is this incredible amount of overstimulation of the senses that, you know, you just watch people driving and watch people working out and watch people walking down the street. Everybody's trying to do two or three things at once. And a psychologist has now called that partial attention syndrome, that she thinks that most Americans are unable to focus on anything for a long time. And I used the example recently, I went into Soledad Chapel, and I was about an hour late getting in because of an old charge that's popping up on my security check, and Soledad was making a big deal of it. And so I walked into the chapel about an hour after my workshop was supposed to start, and there's about 200 men in there, and the room is quiet, calm. People are talking a little bit to the person around them or whatever, and nothing's happening, and they were waiting an hour. And I thought to myself, I can't imagine a university audience, a church congregation, a spiritual center anywhere where I could be an hour late and walk into a calm, quiet room with everybody still there. And the reason that these men are that calm and quiet and patient is a terrible reason. It's because, you know, you have a doctor's appointment, go sit on that chair in that hall right there at 9 o'clock in the morning, and then 2 in the afternoon somebody comes by, what are you doing there? Well, I had a doctor's appointment at 9. The doctor's not coming in today. Get back to your cell.
Oh, my.
Now, but what has developed in response to that kind of treatment is these guys have learned how to wait. Mm-hmm. These guys have learned how to stay calm. Mm-hmm. And the people out on the street have not learned how to wait, have not learned how to stay calm, even for 2 minutes, let alone an hour. So I come into prisons and say, you know, the idea that most people have coming in is they're going to help you get your GED. They're going to help you get some job training so you can jump out there and become as dysfunctional, addicted, and depressed and unhappy as everybody else, constantly running after consumer crap like the dog running after the rabbit around the racetrack. They never get to catch the rabbit.
If they wanted to be like most people, whatever that is, they wouldn't have wound up in prison, you know. It's their rebellion against just the way so many of us are living that got them on the path, that got them where they are, you know.
Yeah, and so I come around saying, well, you know, that train that you got kicked off of, it wrecked, and it wrecks daily. So it's not such a bad idea to have been thrown off. Let's look at those good qualities that you've developed in relationship to this adversity or in response to this adversity that we put you in. Prison is an adverse situation. I sincerely believe that in the next two or three years, the mainstream culture is going to face a period of adversity as at least as significant as something the size of the stock market crash of 1929 that ushered in the Great Depression. I feel like society, American society, is right on the cusp of something at least that significant that affects everybody in the country. And so what we have here is this ironic situation where people in prison have learned how to handle adversity, have learned how to be patient when nothing works right and when promises don't get met, and have learned how to be calm in the face of anger. And so people on the streets are actually going to need those qualities. So I come in and tell these guys, you know, we need you not to get out and be frothing at the mouth to jump back out to the mall, but to get out and realize that you're the guys with real human being qualities and that you need to be an influence on them rather than them trying to help you catch up with all this crap that they've been buying while you've been in prison. And so it is a little bit of a different and an interesting perspective. And for me, it still revolves squarely around around a sense of activism, a sense of community, and doing the deep inner contemplative work that is required to know how to face adversity and how to be a deep person in a superficial culture.
Well, and you bring into focus for them a feeling of self-worth, that there is something to go out there for and to do and to be a part of that is worthwhile, and not the feeling that they're going to go out there and be some sort of useless piece of garbage that will be mistreated, misdirected again. And I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I say you guys are the ones that we need. You guys are the ones who have to come out and sort of be elders and influences.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just about getting a job for the most money you can. I mean, I have a friend who did 18 years in Alabama for murder, and we helped him get out. And in August, it'll be 3 years that he's been out. He's working full-time as a counselor at a substance abuse place called Freedom House in North Carolina, and it's a recovery community. And so he gets to help hundreds and hundreds of addicts go into recovery, avoid prison, and he's doing a wonderful job. And he also has his commercial driver's license, and a couple months ago he got offered, a friend of his from Alabama called and said, who owns a trucking company, and said, you can drive a long-distance rig for me, which is something Bud would love to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make about $70,000 a year. And Bud is currently making $27,000 a year at Freedom House. And Bud and I talked about it. Of course, he was tempted enough to consider it. But the plain truth of it is, his life's not just about making as much money as he can so that he can spend it all on the crap that everybody spends their money on. Right now, he's helping hundreds of addicts. He's he's a sponsor to about 25 people in NA and AA, and he's a professional in substance abuse, and the difference in salary is almost $50,000 a year.
But he feels like the job he has is helping him give back to someone some of the things that brought him out of the darkness.
Yeah, this is a life that's about something, and you can't just measure that in terms of financial success, like basically everybody tells you to do in America. And so this is the kind of, you know, this is the kind of spirituality and activism that our ministry is about, is, yeah, do your inner work, learn meditation, learn how to sit still and be quiet and tune into something that is more great and more noble than ourselves, and then take that and live for something bigger than yourself as well. Because I feel like the biggest problem in American life is that, and I wrote this years ago and a lot of people picked it up on the internet, that the problems of all the problems of our personal problems and the problems of the planet can be summed up in a single sentence. Human life is very deep, and our dominant modern lifestyle is not. It's just not deep. So we're talking about people while they're inside, even people who are never getting out, learning how to live a deep and meaningful life. And if they do get out, they bring that deep and meaningful life out to a family and a community that might be clueless about a deep and meaningful life. They may never have taken the time to think about a deep and meaningful life. So that's the kind of thing that we introduce to people while they're locked up.
Well, I have to say, they told me the part about working hard to earn a lot of money, but they forgot to offer me that $70,000 a year job. So it never quite went in that direction. You know, I want to talk about your book a little bit. I want to tell our listening audience of Prison Pipeline that your book has three parts. And that the first part is kind of an introduction, and the second part has a lot to do with meditation and yoga. And the third part has to do with letters. And what I like about the letters in your book is that you have printed letters that you received from people who have participated in your program, and then you also print your answer to that person. And I find that that has really focused on just what is that letter about, where are they going from there, what is the follow-up of your program. And, you know, I really want to commend you for including all those answers. It just makes such good reading, and it makes it all so informative and so real. Did you want to talk about some of the experiences of folks who, after they've participated in your program and they're released, that they keep in touch with you and what becomes of their lives?
Well, a lot of people I know who get out of prison are very motivated to try to do some work like Bud in the recovery field or working with at-risk kids, doing some kind of payback kind of work. And of course, we encourage that tremendously. It's living for something that you feel is bigger than just your own interests. And even people who aren't going to have a full-time job in something like that, I tell people when we talk about getting out that, you know, of equal importance to having a job and a place to stay, equal importance is finding out who the good people are in your community doing good works and introducing yourself to them and telling them that you want to be a part of it, you want to be a volunteer. That's of equal importance. It doesn't come after you've gotten all of your scene together to your satisfaction, because, of course, that never happens.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the big problems that we have is this: the whole American dream is just based on looking after yourself and trying to get what you want and what you need. And people try to do that who get out of prison, and it's just not enough, because prison was profound. It may have been brutally negative profound, but it was profound. You see people killed over a pack of cigarettes. That's profound. It's like being in the front lines of a war together. You get out, and nothing is profound. It's just about paying bills. And there's this stress that builds up around just keeping up with the day's needs and bills. And there's that need for profundity is missing. And so I tell people that it's really just as important as getting a job and a place to stay, finding out what's going on in your community. Is there Habitat for Humanity? Is there organizations that work with at-risk youth? Are there organizations, are there local ministers who are trying to clean up crack neighborhoods, or, you know, do some work with boys after school? Or, you know, what's going on in your community? At least going to a 12 steps group and, you know, becoming somebody's sponsor. Not just going to stuff that you think has things that you need, but offering your value and doing it in a realistic way. You still have to make a living. You still have to figure that kind of stuff out. But knowing that man really doesn't live by bread alone.
That's true.
You know, and that you need to, and of course, once somebody connects with the good people in the community, the activists, the people who are really trying to make a positive difference, then they're in a whole different group of people than they ever were also. And that really does help them make a new set of community, a new set of friends, and not go back to the same old that leads you back to prison.
Right.
So a lot of the people who have worked with our materials, and we don't really have a program as such, we have ideas that we're sharing and that we base our own lives around. This doesn't just have to do with prisoners. So a lot of the people who work with our ideas and who correspond with us for years and all certainly get those ideas, and they take them out to their communities, and they make a huge difference in the places where they are. I mean, we, you know, by people wanting ex-cons just to keep their heads down and stay out of sight, most communities are losing out on an enormous source of
really
good resource for helping others.
Well, we both knew that this half hour was going to go fast, and we do still have a few more minutes. There's one more thing I want to light on. Many of our listeners have loved ones, family, friends, who are still in prison or will be released soon, and when they come out, I'm thinking about the support that they need to give to these people. Isn't it just as important as all these other things you've mentioned to have a good support team there? And do you have any suggestions to friends and loved ones of recently released folks?
Well, I get a little nervous about words like support, and I especially hate the term aftercare, which I hear a lot, because prisoners need to be, I mean, the support they need is how to connect to give their value and to step up to the plate and take their share of the burdens, of the responsibilities. Most prisoners' families, as they know, have, they've been just as beset with adversity since
yes.
their loved one has been in prison as the prisoner himself. So I see the prisoner getting out, and of course it's great if the family is there and helps to make the connection into the community and so forth, but not to give the prisoner what he needs, but to enable the prisoner to step up and help fill the needs of others as well. And
how about a little love?
Yeah, it just, you know, we all need to feel like we have value. And I think too many people see somebody getting out of prison as this object of all the attention, support, help, resource. And what is the prisoner's value other than taking? You know, that's probably what got him in prison in the first place, is this attitude that everybody owes him and he can take whatever he needs. So I just see it as, how do we, as quickly as possible, help somebody transition into a situation where he also is accountable, or she, are accountable to others, that they have a function in the household, they have a function in the community, they may be helped to find a job or whatever, but it also is like, well, then, you know, we also need you to help out in the ways that you've been missing since you've been gone.
Well, that's certainly good comments. You know, I feel like we could talk on and on and on, and I was wondering, what do you think about connecting this war on terror and other actions of our present administration to the plight of those who have been in the program or in the prison? Do you think that it's particularly hard times? Is this a particularly difficult decade to be incarcerated and then released?
Oh, yeah, and that's part of the message that I'm trying to bring prisoners is, please, we're going to be facing a national crisis of major proportions in the next couple of years. Don't be shocked, don't be surprised, and don't be caught off guard. And we need you to come out. While you've been in prison, you've been wearing all blue for 16, 17 years. You see that you don't need a lot of clothes. You don't need a lot of variety of fashion. Remember that when you get out, because the whole country is going to be in a period of adversity, and you're going to be the one who says, oh, I've been learning how to live with adversity for the last 17 years.
That's true.
So I think this is, I think before 2010, everyone in America is going to be living differently. I don't know exactly what shape, whether it's going to be ecological, political, military, economic, but something as big as the stock market crash and the Great Depression, where we survived it and we rebuilt, mm-hmm. but everybody in America was affected by the stock market crash of 1929. I think there's something coming up because of this administration, because of the unsustainability of all our policies, from ecological to genocidal.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's something coming up within the next couple of years, not 2040 or 2050, but something coming up, whether the stock market's going to crash again, whether there are going to be fierce storms that just lash the whole country and bring us to our knees and bankrupt the federal government, or whether China goes to war with us over oil and they're going to say, we're not Iraq. You know, whatever it is, something is going to change our lifestyle in the next 2 or 3 years. And so it's a very difficult time to be in prison or getting out of prison, but I would like for the people listening to this show to be among the people who can say when that happens, oh, many of us saw this coming, and civilizations rise and civilizations fall. Periods of prosperity are followed by periods of adversity. These are natural world cycles because we became arrogant and selfish and cruel. So we can do this. We can reach inward, and we can hold hands, we can join arms in this. We can do this, just like there's still Romans in Rome, even though the Roman Empire fell. There's still Americans in America after the 1929 stock market crash and the Great Depression. We're going to need to be the people who say we can do this, and we can make better decisions about how to be good citizens in the world and how to punish less, how to empower more. You know, just we're going to have a comeuppance of a major level in the next couple of years, and I hope our prisoner friends and their families can be among those who are sort of ready to say, yeah, we know how to live with little. We already know how to figure out how to solve our own problems. We've been having to do that in prison for years.
Well, I certainly agree with you on that. The upcoming events, you picked the year 2010. I don't know if it's going to take 2 years or 10 years, but certainly an earthquake or a volcano eruption or a financial crash or a revolution of some sort against our administration. I wanted to remind our listeners that you've been listening to Bo Lazoff, who is the author of a book, We're All Doing Time. We've also been listening to one of his CDs, Whatever It Takes. The first song, music that we heard was When It Rains. And when we leave the air, we're going to go out on Like a Moth to a Flame, which are both songs about prisoners. And we certainly appreciate that you've given us this time and these insights. And I feel like I'm just going to keep my eyes and ears open every time I see or hear anything that you're writing or singing. I'm going to be there. And I appreciate you being here with me, Bo. So I'm going to be saying goodbye and thank you. Thank you so much for sharing all these wonderful thoughts with us.
Well, thank you, and I really support and appreciate your show and hope you keep on doing it.
Well, we are sure going to try. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Okay, folks, we're going to go out with a little music. We're going to go out with Like a Moth to a Flame being played by Bo Lazoff. I want to thank the engineer who's been assisting me. I certainly want to thank Bo again. And most of all, I want to thank you, our listeners. Keep in touch with us. Prison Pipeline has an audience that we want to serve. And if you have things you want to hear or do, you give us a call, write us a letter, let us know what your wishes are, let us know how you feel about the things we're presenting. One moment, please. And I think that if you wanted to get in touch with us, you could call the KBOO station at 503-231-3032. I got that number wrong. 503-231-8032. That's the KBOO station. And we can contact you after you call us, or you can send me an email at ruth.kovacs, K-O-V-A-C-S, at worldnet.att.net. And most of all, keep your hearts with us and know that we're keeping our hearts and thoughts with you. Thank you so much.